air drone attack in Moscow as more air assaults hit Ukraine's capital.
President Putin claims it's an attempt from Kyiv to intimidate Russia and that it's a clear sign of terrorist activities.
Plus, hate crimes and anti-Semitism on the rise as family members seek accountability for the mass murders at a U.S. synagogue 5 years ago.
2018 Tree of Life shooting was the deadliest attack against the Jewish community in American history.
And aid groups warn of a looming cholera catastrophe in Kenya. Today is Wednesday, May 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. A U.S. military aid package for Ukraine that's expected to be announced this week will total up to $300 million and will include additional munitions for drones, according to U.S. officials. The drone ammunition comes after a rare unmanned aircraft targeted Moscow before dawn early Tuesday. Associated Press correspondent Lawrence Brooks has more.
It's the first time residential buildings have been struck in the Russian capital since the war in Ukraine began. The Russian Defense Ministry says five drones were shot down and the systems of three others were jammed, causing them to veer off course. Moscow's mayor says two people have received treatment for unspecified injuries but were not hospitalized. President Putin claims it's an attempt from Kyiv to intimidate Russia and that it's a clear sign of terrorist activities. Ukraine has made no direct comment on the attack. The Kremlin, meanwhile, has pursued its relentless bombardment of Kyiv with a third assault on the city in 24 hours. I'm Lawrence Brooks.
The latest drone attack on Moscow may indicate Ukraine's long-awaited spring counteroffensive is already underway. Ukrainian officials had no direct comment. There has been no suggestion that U.S.-made drones or munitions were used in the attacks on Moscow. VOA Ukrainian service correspondent Katerina Lisunova spoke to Michael McFaul, a former U.S. ambassador to Russia, who is now a professor of international studies at Stanford's Department of Political Science. She asked him what sort of reaction can be expected from Western allies.
So first, I don't know if this is an attack from the government of Ukraine on Russia. They have not confirmed that, so I want to be careful about how I describe it. Second, the very notion of calling it an attack is also being disputed because there hasn't been any casualties. There haven't been any fatalities. But that said, it does appear that these were Ukrainian-made drones. And that, I think, is an important distinction because many Western governments have talked about their reservations of providing their weapon systems to be used to attack the Russian Federation. But they have not expressed a view about whether Ukraine might use their own weapon systems to bring the war to Russia. So I think this is consistent with the policy agreements that have been done with Kyiv.
Can we talk right now about expansion of the war and probably answering Russia on their territory?
It most certainly appears that way. Again, the Ukrainian government denies everything. We need to keep saying that. The attack in Belgorod, they said they had nothing to do with. Those were Russians, appears to be from the Russian Federation, to the best of reporting. But it does feel like there is a new strategy to bring the war to the Russian Federation, not just to the occupied territories of Crimea and Donbass. And I think it's not a coincidence that they may be happening precisely when Ukraine goes on the counteroffensive.
What could be results of this expansion of war on Russian territory in Russia itself? Could we expect some reaction from Russian people, for example?
Yeah, I think there'll be multiple kinds of reactions. On the one hand, you already see it on Russian television. The pro-Putin propagandists are going crazy about this stuff, saying we need to fight harder and bigger and make a new mobilization. That's one reaction. The other reaction, however, might be that will be harder for us to see because it's impossible to do polling in a dictatorship like Russia. But the other reaction might be, why are we fighting this war? Now that this war is threatening us, what are we doing there? And I think the longer the war goes on, that sentiment will grow no matter what, but it'll grow even faster if the war appears to be affecting people's daily lives.
In the same time, Ukraine right now suffers from more than 3 days of intensive attacks from Russia. How can you explain this escalation of attacks from Moscow on territory of Ukraine and specifically on Kyiv.
Again, I don't know exactly, you know, I don't know what Mr. Putin is thinking. I think he's running out of military objectives. His military has not performed well at any stage in this war. Remember, there was supposed to be an offensive by Russia several months ago, and all you got was just this horrific killing and destruction in Bakhmut. They cannot advance on the battlefield in any way, shape, or form, so they have to resort to terrorism. In my mind, what they're doing to Kyiv right now, that is terrorism. They are targeting civilians to terrorize the people of Ukraine. And that's what you do when you're desperate, not when you feel like you're winning.
Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, speaking with my colleague, Katerina Lysanova. Opening statements were heard Tuesday in the trial of the man accused of killing 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 2018. Associated Press correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
It's the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. Even Robert Bauer's lawyers agree. Lead attorney Judy Clark says Bauer shot every person he saw at the Tree of Life Synagogue. She questioned whether Bauer's had acted out of hatred or an irrational belief that he needed to kill Jews to save others from the genocide he claimed they were enabling by helping immigrants come to the U.S. The defense strategy is to try to spare Bauer's from a possible death sentence. Prosecutors described for jurors Bauer's terror as he moved through the synagogue. Assistant U.S. Attorney Sue Song said the depths of the defendant's malice and hate can only be proven in the broken bodies. The families of those killed are divided whether to pursue the death penalty. I'm Ed Donahue.
For analysis on these targeted mass murders and the continued rise in hate crimes and anti-Semitism in the U.S., I spoke with Oren Siegel, vice president of the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism. So he could face the death penalty if he's convicted of the some 63 counts he faces. The defense is hoping to persuade the jury to spare his life. What are the victims and families hoping to see?
First and foremost, people want to see justice. They want to see accountability, and they want to be able to come to some resolution, knowing that, you know, full resolution is probably never possible. For some, that means seeking out the ultimate penalty. For others, it may not. I think people have very different views on what justice means for them. And I think we ought to respect the differences that people in communities have about that. But I think overall, one thing everybody can agree on is the need for accountability and for justice. And I think all the community basically follows those principles.
Accountability is hopefully a deterrent for something in the future. But unfortunately, it would appear that the rise in anti-Semitism in this country and even around the world seems to be rising. I'm hearing that threats against the Jewish people ticked up since the trial proceedings began, but apparently incidents of anti-Semitism in the U.S. reached an all-time high, according to your statistics, in 2022. Do you expect to see that number rise again this year?
It's too early to tell what the numbers will be. That's something that we'll put together at the end of the year. But when you look at, you know, the nearly 5 years that have passed since the horrible tragedy at Squirrel Hill, we have seen historic highs of anti-Semitic incidents reported to us at ADL. And that's harassment, that's vandalism, and that's assault as well. And in addition, you know, we've seen mass casualty attacks motivated by the same ideologies that motivated the shooter in this case. And so, you know, you would think 5 years later, there would have been some sort of reckoning for what happened. But the sad reality is anti-Semitic incidents continue to be reported at historically high levels all this time later. And that's where I think, you know, having some accountability, some sort of resolution in this case, if not a deterrent, will at least demonstrate that there are consequences. And I think at a time of rising hate and extremism and anti-Semitism, consequences is an important message that this trial represents.
And just last week, a man rammed a U-Haul into one of the barriers at the White House and said he wanted to kill the president. And then police found a Nazi flag in his vehicle. And it just seems like there's a growing affinity for Nazism and an affinity for Hitler. Has this always been the case? Or is anti-Semitism and extremism just becoming more normalized and out in the open?
I mean, anti-Semitism and hatred has always been there, right? I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years. ADL has been tracking anti-Semitic incidents for over 40 and has been in existence for well beyond that. So it's not that anti-Semitism is new. It's not that violence and extremism is new. I think what is new is that it's become normalized. I think the volume is greater than before. The access to Nazi symbols and ideology and hatred on social media, that's something that wasn't always in existence. And frankly, I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing so much of this activity on the ground, the numbers rising. It's because access to hate, the ability to leverage that hate is just easier than in any other time in human history. And you mentioned DC and what we saw just last week. There was somebody with perhaps the most well-known symbol of hate targeting perhaps one of the most well-known symbols of democracy. And I think that is part of this sort of rising hate. It's the normalization and the way that it's being used as a blunt tool to undermine values in our country and in our democracy. So there's a lot going on and a lot to unpack.
And is it true that Jews are the dominant target of hate crimes in the United States?
So according to FBI statistics, in terms of religiously motivated hate, the Jewish community is consistently the most targeted. Even though it represents 2% or so of the population, it's often, 60, 70% of the amount of religiously motivated hate crimes. And that's another statistic that I think demonstrates this sort of moment in time that we have in this country.
Well, apparently President Biden is paying attention. Of course, as you know, last week he released a new plan to combat the rise in anti-Semitism. Is that a good start?
Yeah, so having, the White House release a strategy to combat anti-Semitism is a clear sign that A, there's a serious problem in this country of anti-Semitism, but B, that society is starting to find ways to respond. Having the White House and the government put out a plan that has many details of how to push back against this hatred is a really important step. Hopefully it will help mobilize communities to fight not only anti-Semitism, but other forms of hate. And it just brings to bear the power of government on an issue that so many people in the Jewish community feel somewhat helpless about, right? At a time where the Jewish community is feeling vulnerable, the message that a White House strategy sends is critical in terms of acknowledging the threat. And now we have to put it into practice.
Oren Siegel, Vice President of the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism. Intense clashes could be heard in Sudan's capital on Tuesday after military factions battling for more than 6 weeks agreed to extend a ceasefire aimed at allowing aid to reach civilians. As Henry Wilkins reports from Adre Chad, witnesses who've escaped the city of Jenina say their hometown is being ripped apart.
It's around 8 a.m. in Adre Chad, a town on the country's border with Sudan. Chadian citizens are returning from Jenina, the capital of West Darfur State, which some experts say has experienced more intense fighting than Sudan's capital, Khartoum, in recent weeks. One returnee spoke to VOA just after crossing the border from Sudan. She asked to remain anonymous to protect her family's safety.
It started at the beginning of Ramadan. A lot of problems. They burned the houses and killed people too. A lot of them. At first, they were on the outskirts of the city, but then they came to the interior neighborhoods. They robbed the market. They broke everything, especially in stores and markets. They took everything from them.
The returnees say they fled the city under the cover of darkness to avoid being shot. Moments later, horse-drawn carts carrying Sudanese refugees fleeing Jenina arrive. Sudanese refugee Abdul Anasser Abdallah Adam described how much of the city was affected by the fighting.
All of it. Militants burned all the military campsites. Nothing left. Everything was destroyed and robbed. I mean, all the facilities of the city are now destroyed, starting from hospitals, police stations, schools, etc.
Fighting between Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces, which this video purports to show, is tearing the city apart. It's unclear how many people have been killed in Jenina since the fighting began. Since May 19th, the cell phone networks in the city have stopped working altogether, leading many to worry about the fate of relatives and associates still there. Mathilde Vu of the Norwegian Refugee Council say the aid group fears the worst for its colleagues in the city.
which therefore has seen very high level of violence over this past month. There's been several attacks. There's been complete mayhem, basically, in the middle of the city with shelling of residential areas, of snipers targeting people. There's been completely burned down of displacement camps, and a lot of people have had to flee somewhere in the city, but nowhere is actually safe.
The population of Janina was around 250,000, but tens of thousands have fled to refugee sites in Chad, like Barotta. Refugees say it's dangerous to leave the city and dangerous to stay. So many people simply don't know what to do. The International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, says the humanitarian situation is dire.
Access to food is getting increasingly difficult. About 3 million people that were there displaced even before the current crisis. So people, they have been through a lot already, and their resilience have been weakened by all these multiple challenges. And now they are facing this new round of violence where they have to flee their homes again.
Many Saddam watchers on social media complain that media attention has focused broadly on fighting in Khartoum, giving less attention to the intense fighting in West Darfur. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Adra, Chad.
Lawmakers in the U.S. House of Representatives on Tuesday started to consider legislation to suspend the government's $31.4 trillion debt ceiling until early 2025 so it can borrow more money to keep paying the country's bills. The U.S. Treasury Secretary warned of a June 5th deadline to avoid a potentially catastrophic default. We're following these other stories from around the world. NATO will send 700 more troops to northern Kosovo to help quell violent protests after clashes with ethnic Serbs there left 30 international soldiers wounded. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said an additional reserve battalion would be put on high readiness in case additional troops are needed. Two jailed female Iranian journalists who helped break the story of the case of a 22-year-old woman who died in police custody last September have gone on trial in Iran. The death of Mahsa Amini, who was accused of wearing her headscarf too loosely, sparked nationwide anti-government protests. Heavy fighting has been reported in central Somalia after al-Shabaab militants stormed a government military camp in the town of Masagawe on Tuesday, the second attack in days. Security sources who are following the situation say deadly fighting ensued between government forces and al-Shabaab following the militant attack. This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Medical care providers in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp say an ongoing cholera outbreak is a looming catastrophe. Doctors Without Borders has described the six-month-long cholera outbreak as the worst yet amid an influx of refugees from Somalia. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
Médecins Sans Frontières, popularly known as Doctors Without Borders, told a news conference Tuesday that a cholera outbreak in Kenya as the Dadaab refugee camp is approaching an epidemic and that urgent attention in the areas of water and sanitation is needed. Dr. Nitya Uderaj is the medical coordinator.
The humanitarian conditions there are already at its limit. So when you have an outbreak like cholera or measles, it's literally the last straws that bring it to the breaking point. The humanitarian situation is already precarious. After 6 months, if the outbreak still continues, it's not normal.
The cholera outbreak hit East Africa's largest refugee camp last November. At least 5 people have died since then. The Dadaab complex in Kenya's northeastern region is home to over 300,000 refugees, most from neighboring Somalia. Their numbers have exceeded capacity due to the extended drought in Somalia. At least 67,000 more refugees arrived in the camp last year, according to national data, putting pressure on already limited resources. Doctors Without Borders country director Hassan Mayaki explains.
Today, according to humanitarian organization working in the camp, almost half the camp population have no access to functional latrine, leading to open defection in and around the camp, which raises the risk of disease outbreaks.
Kenya's Ministry of Health carried out cholera vaccinations at the camp, but the doctors say curbing the outbreak remains elusive without sanitation and hygiene intervention. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Women artists examining their lives and cultures in an exhibition featuring art from the Middle East and other areas is now on display in Los Angeles. Mike O'Sullivan takes a look at the exhibition Women Defining Women, which explores the roles of women in traditional societies and in modern life.
75 works, 42 artists, many of them from Muslim-majority countries in North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, and beyond. The exhibition, Women Defining Women, is intended to start conversations. Linda Komaroff is curator and department head of art of the Middle East at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art.
Every artist in the exhibition is a woman, and the subjects are all women, or in one case, a transgender woman.
From politically themed art to glimpses of everyday life in societies that blend tradition and modernity, Iran-born artist Nusha Tavakolian explored a coming-of-age transition in the series The Day I Became a Woman.
She's using her niece as a model here, and it reflects an event in her niece's life.
When clothing styles, responsibilities, and restrictions change from childhood to adulthood, other artists explore similar cultural themes. A video installation from Turkish artist Inci Evinar blends reality and fantasy as it looks at life in a harem, the part of a traditional Muslim household reserved for wives and female relatives and servants. Egyptian-born Shireen Gerges, who lives in California, says her mixed-media creations were inspired by Egyptian themes and her life today.
The roots of feminism in Egypt and that, you know, that filtered through my childhood, but also trying to understand or trying to kind of be in conversation with what's happening with women's rights today here in America.
The curator says the exhibition reflects the diversity of life in the artist's native countries.
The idea behind it is basically trying to change American attitudes and stereotypical ideas about women in the Middle East, especially from Islamic lands.
Who, like women everywhere, are products of their cultural traditions and the modern world. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As the largest Pacific Island country, a democracy, APEC member, and regional energy provider, Papua New Guinea is a key partner for the United States in the Indo-Pacific region. On a recent visit to the island nation, Secretary of State Antony Blinken signed a defense cooperation agreement which he said will enhance Papua New Guinea's defense forces' capability to deliver humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, including through providing medical care and temporary shelter to those who are affected by crises. He added the agreement will also make it easy for Papua New Guinea and U.S. forces to train together in new ways and in more places as part of our joint effort to uphold peace and security across the Indo-Pacific. In addition, Secretary Blinken signed an agreement concerning counter-illicit transnational maritime activity operations with Papua New Guinea, which addresses a range of maritime threats, including illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, drug trafficking, migrant smuggling, and illicit transport of weapons of mass destruction. This agreement adds to the 11 existing agreements within the Pacific Island region and strengthens maritime governance and enforcement globally. This new agreement will enable Papua New Guinea to participate in the U.S. Coast Guard Shiprider Program, which is aimed at combating illicit maritime activities. At more than 2.4 million square kilometers, the Papua New Guinea Exclusive Economic Zone is one of the largest in the South Pacific, noted Secretary Blinken. That poses a tremendous economic opportunity, but also a serious challenge for monitoring, for controlling, for surveilling that vast expanse of maritime area. Under this agreement, our forces will be able to board one another's vessels, share technical expertise, and ultimately better patrol the seas together. With these agreements in place, the United States and Papua New Guinea can deliver a strong, united response to actors that continue to engage in predatory behavior, as well as those who disregard territorial integrity and responsible and respectful use of marine resources.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.